This is Minnesota Educational Radio in St. Paul and Minneapolis, KSJN at 91.1 megahertz.
A three-judge federal court in New York has granted the federal government a stay of a lower court order to stop the bombing of Cambodia. Archibald Cox says that he's confident that President Nixon will abide by a Supreme Court decision on the disputed presidential tapes and papers. John Ehrlichman has given some details to the Senate Watergate Committee of a spy plot against Senator Edmund Muskie in last year's pre-convention presidential campaign. Following our news report this noon, live from the National Press Club in Washington, Senator Lowell Weicker, Republican of Connecticut, a member of the Senate Watergate Committee, will talk to the reporters and answer their questions. That coming up in just 29 minutes. The news is brought to you with the financial assistance of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Catholic Aid Fraternal Life Insurance Association. This is Marvin Granger reporting. A three-judge federal court of appeals in New York granted a stay of a lower court ruling which had barred further U.S. military activities in Cambodia. The action came this morning just 5 hours before the lower court ruling was to take effect at 4 o'clock New York time this afternoon. A panel deliberated only 10 minutes and set a hearing for August 13th in Manhattan Federal Court. On Wednesday of this week, Brooklyn Federal Court Judge Orrin Judd is his name, declared U.S. military operations in Cambodia to be unconstitutional and unlawful, and he ordered them to stop today at 4 o'clock, as I said. Judge Judd also issued a permanent injunction against the Defense Department and the Air Force, barring them from any military activities, which include bombing, in Cambodia. Judge Wilfred Feinberg said this morning that the federal government's arguments meet the traditional test for granting a stay. He said that if either side in a dispute wants to further accelerate the matter, they can file motions next week. The hearing date of August 13th falls just 2 days before the administration has agreed, through it with Congress, that it will halt all bombing in Cambodia anyway. Special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox said this morning that he's confident that President Nixon will surrender White House tape recordings on his Watergate conversations if the Supreme Court ultimately orders him to do so. Cox said that he could not envision any circumstance in which the court would not make a definitive judgment in the case if called upon to do so. Quoting Cox, "Our history has been one of our presidents complying with constitutional decisions of the courts. I don't assume this president will do anything different than his predecessors," unquote. Cox told a news conference that a Supreme Court decision would be the quickest way to resolve the dispute. He refused to concede that the court might render a judgment that would simply tell the president what his obligations are without specifically ordering him to turn the tapes over to the federal grand jury investigators or to the special prosecutor. Cox added, and I quote him again, "I intend to push forward in the courts rigorously." Cox said the tapes are highly relevant for determining not only whether President Nixon was involved personally in the Watergate cover-up, but also whether some of his aides were involved in the cover-up, and to ascertain whether perjury might have been committed by some witnesses who have appeared before the Watergate grand jury in Washington. Cox initiated court action yesterday, soon after President Nixon officially notified him, as well as the Senate Watergate Committee, that the White House would not comply with the subpoenas requesting the tapes. A hearing has been set for August 7th in Federal District Court on a show cause order issued yesterday by Federal Judge John Sirica. Cox says he views his attempt to get the tapes as an action that he was taking as an arm of the grand jury and not as a part of the executive branch of the government. He says he has continued to operate absolutely independently of the Nixon administration. The Senate Watergate Committee will file suit next week to force President Nixon to turn over Watergate-related tapes of his White House conversations. Yesterday, after President Nixon formally rejected subpoenas for the tapes from the Watergate Committee and from Special Prosecutor Cox, the Watergate Committee decided to press the suit. Chief Counsel Samuel Dash says the committee will most likely seek a ruling by the courts that the committee has a right to subpoena presidential tapes and order Nixon to turn the tapes over to the committee. A Nixon spokesman says the president expects the courts to rule in his favor, upholding his refusal to hand over the tapes. The president's reasoning for not turning the tapes over is based on the separation of powers as outlined in the Constitution. His refusal, that is, to give the tapes to the Senate committee. That argument does not necessarily apply, or does not apply in the same way, to the Cox subpoenas. Whatever the outcome in the courts, the White House spokesman says that President Nixon will abide by it. John Ehrlichman has told the Senate Watergate Committee that in April of this year, he learned about a second intelligence operation in the committee to re-elect President Nixon last year. Ehrlichman said this operation involved a former cab driver who got a job as a chauffeur for Senator Edmund Muskie, who was seeking the Democratic presidential nomination in the primary campaigns last spring. The spring of 72. According to what Ehrlichman said he learned, the chauffeur became a close friend of Muskie and of his family. He picked up and delivered the senator's mail and photographed all of it for the president's reelection committee. He turned his information over to E. Howard Hunt, one of the convicted Watergate conspirators. The other intelligence operation in the committee to re-elect the president was the Watergate operation, the burglary and the bugging of the Democratic headquarters in the Watergate complex. Today is Ehrlichman's fourth day of testimony. The committee is expected to question the former White House aide most of today. In fact, they may not get to another witness until next week. During the course of the Watergate hearings, the seven senators who sit on the investigating committee are required very often to leave the hearing room and go to the Senate floor for a vote. You may have wondered, as others have, how they keep themselves informed of what's going on in the Senate and how they make decisions about non-Watergate issues upon which they have to vote. Linda Wertheimer and Mike Waters may shed some light on that.
They have several ways of dealing with the problem. Most senators know how they're going to vote on a bill, on the final passage of a bill, because after all, the bill's been around for a long time, and they have formed an opinion on it, and they've made a decision about it. It's all those amendments that come between the introduction and final passage that can be confusing. The amendments aren't always printed. You can't always be briefed in advance as to what they are. So it's really kind of an ad hoc thing. As the senators get up from the table, they can be told by the committee staff, who can find out from the cloakroom by telephone what amendment it is they'll be voting on. But in any case, they get up and they go over to the floor, they walk in the door, and they ask somebody how to vote. Now, generally, they ask the staff of the majority and minority party, the secretaries of the majority and minority. Those two men station themselves by the doors, themselves or their staff. And as the senators come in and say, what are we voting on? They explain it. And often members of the other senators will be standing by to explain the fine points, to persuade them to vote one way or another. So they're met by people as they come in the door, suggesting, you know, how they should vote.
Now, Linda, supposing, say, a Democratic senator who does not agree with the prevailing Democratic thoughts on a particular subject asks a staff member of his party or the majority party how to vote. Will he be told how the party, the prevailing party thought, or will it be individualized to the point of, Senator, you probably would wish to vote negatively on this. Most of the party is voting positively.
Well, just the very thing you described does happen. I mean, after all, these people are the servants of the senators, and they aim to please. So they don't want to tell the senator that he should vote yes, and he does vote yes, and then his constituents write him letters saying, why did you vote yes?
Mm-hmm.
So he wants to do the right thing, and they try to advise him to do the right thing. But if he has any problems with it or any doubts with it, there are several things that senators do. One thing is to fly to the side of a senator of like persuasion and say, how do I vote? And I see that happening all the time. Another thing is to go to the staff of the committee that the bill was reported out of, because the staff on that committee are not only experts on the bill, they're also experts on the voting records of the senators on the committee, and they can help him out with how he should vote on it. And then, too, if it's a bill of very special interest to a senator, he'll have his own staff member either sitting in the gallery or on the floor in the back, and that member of his own personal staff will leave the floor when the vote is called and stand by the elevators waiting for his men and tell them what to do.
Linda, that raises another point. Of course, the Watergate hearings are the center and focus of national attention. on the part of the senators who are not directly in that hearing, is there a sense of not quite being at the center of the action?
Yes, I think there is. And there's a very real problem for senators who always like to be on television and on the radio because it means something to their voters to see them. It's very hard to get in the news if you're a senator but not on the Watergate Committee. And they do have problems. An old doorman on the House side once told me that for members of the congressional religion, Mondays and Fridays are holidays. And it has been true that the Senate generally doesn't meet on Mondays and Fridays, and committees almost never hold hearings on Mondays and Fridays. When the Watergate was only meeting 3 days a week, there were a lot of hearings on Mondays and Fridays as senators were trying to get some public attention for what they were doing and to fight that Watergate. You can imagine how difficult it is with all the Watergate information once he's on television for anything else to get on from the Senate.
That's really a part of keeping an office, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Linda Wertheimer talking there with Mike Waters on last night's All Things Considered about how senators decide how they should vote when they are busy in the Watergate Committee hearings and they are suddenly called to the Senate floor to decide on a non-Watergate issue. Democratic Senator Harold Hughes of Iowa said today that the United States should consider using its economic power to bring about peace in Indochina. In a speech on the Senate floor, Hughes called on the United States to withhold aid to North and South Vietnam both until the Paris Agreement is honored by both parts of Vietnam. The Cambodian government in exile of Prince Norodom Sihanouk charged today that those it called American imperialists and their lackeys ordered bombing campaigns against Cambodia in 1963. That's 6 years earlier than the American bombing raids that are now admitted by the Defense Department in 1969 and 70. The Paris mission of Sihanouk's Government of National Union distributed a statement outlining those charges. Black smoke billowed up from the combat zone just 6 miles south of Phnom Penh today as American B-52 bombers pounded the area in support of Cambodian troops. The government forces are attempting to outflank a creeping insurgent advance on the capital city. Fighting around Phnom Penh is reportedly very heavy. The government is pushing in convoys of trucks and riverboats to Phnom Penh to build up supplies before American bombing is cut off on the 15th of August. The principal military aide of Chile's President Salvador Allende, Navy Captain Arturo Araya, was assassinated early today at his home in Santiago. The government immediately blamed the slaying on the extreme right-wing Fatherland and Liberty movement, which was linked to an unsuccessful effort last month to overthrow President Allende's government. A heavy voter turnout is expected in the Philippine balloting on the martial law regime of President Ferdinand Marcos. Estimates are that up to 20 million persons will go to the polls to decide whether Marcos will be authorized to rule indefinitely in the Philippines. All indications are that voters will authorize his continuation in office beyond the December 31st expiration of his current term. Today's voting has been made compulsory by the government, with no exceptions permitted without justifiable reasons. Those who fail to vote face possible 1 to 6 month terms in prison. In Washington, the federal government announced today its index of leading business indicators made a substantial gain in 1.9% during the month of June. Two key measures of employment activity were down, with the work week declining slightly and unemployment insurance claims up, according to the latest report. The index, based on 8 categories of business performance, is considered one of the key measures of future business activity in the country. The quarterly increase of the index of the second quarter, 2.2%, was the smallest increase since the third quarter of 1971. The nation's second largest commercial bank, the First National City Bank of New York, today announced it's raising its prime lending rate to 8.75%. This is the highest prime rate in history. 0.25% hike had been expected by the bank. Two other banks, the Marine Midland of New York and Girard National Bank of Philadelphia, announced similar increases.